And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, many people bemoan, complain, are exasperated about their work. Many stay in jobs they despise in order to keep medical benefits, even a menial income. Others make big salaries but feel a mere cog of the rat race. Of course, most had childhood aspirations of work, success, and meaningful achievement. And with us now is philosopher and sociologist Roman Krusnarik. He's the author of How to Find Fulfilling Work. He joins us from London. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening to you.
And
good afternoon, actually, probably.
Yes, it is.
We have conflicting reports on the correct pronunciation of your name, Roman. Give us...
You said it absolutely perfectly, Roman Krusnarik.
Okay.
Okay, good. Well, is it always a case of finding more fulfilling work, or is it sometimes a case of making the work that we have more fulfilling?
Well, I think for most of human history, the attitude to work has been it's something that you need to just put up with it, bear the drudgery of it, and don't try and expect too much from it. But I think in the last couple of decades, there's been a rising expectation amongst people for work, which is more than just the salary. So I think that although sometimes we're in circumstances where we don't have the choices to use our talents or put our passions into practice, I think for more and more people, these options are really out there, and more people are hungry for meaningful and purposeful work.
And to what did you attribute that shift?
Well, I think it's partly about long-term changes that... Since the end of the Second World War, in the United States and in Europe, more and more people have had their basic needs satisfied for housing, for food and education and so on. And what you have is what sociologists call the rise of post-material values, which is the idea that, you know, I should be trying to find more meaning in my life, that just paying the bills isn't enough. So it's partly this kind of general economic shift which has been going on. But also, of course, you've had the explosion of the self-help industry and psychotherapy and counseling and all these things have been making people think harder and harder about what the good life really looks like for them. So you've got more and more people asking themselves those searching questions about what would a meaningful job really look like for me.
Is there differences between, say, cultures in Europe versus the more hard-nosed capitalist picture of the United States?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that probably the best piece of career advice in human history comes from ancient Greece 2,000 years ago, and it was something that the philosopher Aristotle said. He said, where the needs of the world and your talents cross, there lies your vocation. Now, that idea to try and find a job where something that you're really good at but something that you really care about is something that's actually important to people on both sides of the Atlantic and in many cultures. That's what the modern research shows, that Aristotle was absolutely right. That if you go seeking just being led, for example, by a job with a big salary or a job which, you know, has very high status, you know, is a very sort of revered profession like being a surgeon or a lawyer or something, you're pretty unlikely to be happy in the long term. But if you find something which embodies your values more, but you're also really good at it, well, then you've got a chance of that longer term career satisfaction. And this really matters, particularly in the United States, where job satisfaction is at an all-time historical low. Only about 45% of people are happy in their jobs.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think partly there's been, you know, a creeping increase in working hours, which is, you know, back in the late 1990s, the United States started beating Japan in terms of how long people worked. But I think it's also this issue of rising expectations. People are asking more and more.
You talk about using empathy and conversation to create social change. Has that ever worked?
Has it ever worked? Oh, yes, it has worked enormously. I mean, if you look back, you know, at human history in the 18th century, the rise of the movements against slavery and the slave trade in North America and Europe were fueled by people trying to step into the shoes of people who were suffering the effects of slavery. And these people were, of course, fueled by their values. And if you look today, what's really interesting when it comes to work that there's more opportunity than ever for actually putting your values into practice in your work. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, if you wanted to do that, you probably had to be a priest or a nun working in an almshouse. But today, you can work in the charity sector for development organizations. You can go and work in the public school system, you know, as a school teacher or a counselor. There's all sorts of things that you can do to try and put your values into practice. And that's an enormous revolution in the world of work. So the chance to find work where you can express your empathic interests and desires is more possible than ever.
So you named three elements that are essential to meaningful and fulfilling work. Let's look at them and what they mean. You have meaning. Of course, I think that one's self-evident. Flow and freedom. I'd like to begin with flow. What is that and how do we achieve that?
Right, so the idea of flow was actually invented by a Hungarian-American psychologist called Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, whose surname's even harder to pronounce than mine and spell. And his idea was this. He did these amazing studies in the 1970s of people in different fields of endeavor and professions. He spoke to surgeons and rock climbers and basketball players, trying to find out, well, when were they most satisfied or happy in what they were doing? And what he discovered was that they got into this state, what he called flow, or what athletes sometimes call being in the zone, where you're so absorbed in what you're doing that nothing else seems to matter. All sense of past and future disappear, and you're absolutely in the present. And that could be when you're scaling a mountain, or when you are doing surgery, or it could be when you're writing a report or doing a presentation in the office. And so Csikszentmihalyi's idea is that we need to try and get ourselves into a state of flow when we're at work. And he says, well, the best way to do that is to set yourself kind of flow tasks which are challenging and creative, but not so difficult that you're worried about failing, but not so easy that you get bored doing them. And that's one of the keys to finding fulfillment. And that's something you can start doing in your existing job. You may not have the courage or the financial security to go walking out of your job tomorrow and finding something more fulfilling. But what you can do is make your own job more enjoyable by trying to do more of these flow tasks.
Well, that's what I was referring to. Would you give an example, though, of flow? Let's say I'm a nurse.
Yeah, so say you're a nurse. Something that you might do is try and shift to doing a different kind of nursing which challenges you more, like, for example, neonatal nursing, you know, working with very, very young children, very, you know, premature babies, something that pushes you a little bit out of your comfort zone, but you've got all the qualifications to do it. So these kinds of shifts, maybe sometimes sideways shifts in an organization, are the ones that can actually start sparking us more and giving us that flow experience.
You say that, what would you say to a person who's a mother, who's a single mother holding down two part-time jobs to keep things together, because you say that that today's material prosperity should free our minds to get to the adventure of life. I don't think she's seeing such an adventure in life holding down that to make ends meet.
That's right. I think the harsh reality sometimes is that you don't have much choice. I mean, when my father was a migrant from Poland to Australia, where I grew up, and he certainly didn't have much choice when he was working two or three jobs at the same time, like the sort of the idea of the mother that you're referring to. And sometimes we don't have those kind of choices. And the reality then is, if you're looking for a fulfilling life, you might have to start searching for it outside the workplace. And of course, there is a long tradition of doing that, where you do your job to make ends meet, and then you try and prize open a bit of leisure time to fulfill your other ambitions in life. You know, a very famous example from the United States is the great early 20th century modernist poet Wallace Stevens, who was a great poet, but he held down a regular job as an insurance executive. And in fact, when he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1955, he was offered a full-time faculty position at Harvard, where he could have sat down for the rest of his life writing poems, but he actually turned it down because he didn't want to give up the job security of his insurance job. You know, so I think the reality is that sometimes we need to find and pursue our passions outside the workplace. But I think even when you're holding down a couple of jobs and trying to make ends meet, there's still sometimes things that you can do. In my book, How to Find Fulfilling Work, I actually interviewed people who worked as domestic cleaners in houses, and the ones who were more fulfilled were the ones who sensed a bit of autonomy, the ones who worked for themselves. Even if they were working long hours, It was actually better to have that freedom to choose who they worked for rather than to work for a big company. And almost every survey of job satisfaction shows that autonomy really matters.
We're speaking with Roman Kruznarek. He's a cultural thinker and writer on the art of living. He's a founding faculty member of the School of Life and advises organizations from Oxfam to the UN on using empathy in conversation to create social change. His book is entitled How to Find Fulfilling Work. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Roman Kruznarek. He's the author of How to Find Fulfilling Work. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email radio@WLRN.org. And you can tweet us. That's at Topical Currents.
So, Roman, you say we should act first and reflect later, which is sounds a little counterintuitive. It's not what we usually hear. How do we do that?
Right. I mean, one of the greatest tragedies of modern work and modern career advice is for the last centuries, we've been told that the best way to find the right job is to effectively think first and then act afterwards. It's called the plan and implement model, where you sit down and make long lists of your strengths and weaknesses and do some psychometric tests and research lots of professions, and then you try and match them up to what you think you want, and then you start sending out resumes and making applications. Now, the thing about that plan and implement model is that you may well get a job, but it's unlikely to be a fulfilling one. And the reason is because you haven't tried those jobs out in reality. You haven't done any experiential learning. And what the latest career research shows is that if you're going to find satisfaction, you need to flip that model on its head. And instead of thinking, then acting, you need to act first and think afterwards. Now, what that actually means is getting out into the world and experimenting, doing job shadowing, doing volunteering, trying to find out in reality what different jobs are like. And an extreme case of this actually is somebody I interviewed for my book, and she took what I think of as a radical sabbatical. So she was very absolutely miserable in her jobs doing cultural and arts administration, and in her late 20s, actually for her 30th birthday, she decided to give herself an unusual birthday present, which was to spend a whole year trying out 30 different jobs. So she managed to pay the bills by working part-time in an administrative job. The rest of the time, she spent some time volunteering as a manager of a cat hotel. Then she followed a politician for a week, shadowing them.
A cat hotel?
A cat hotel.
Not a cat house.
Where was the cat hotel? That's interesting.
This was actually in Belgium,
All
places, but they're all over the world for those who love their feline friends. And she did lots of different things. She worked in advertising for a week and then did a few days with a friend who was a fashion photographer. And what she discovered, and this is really important, was that finding the right job is a bit like finding the right lover. Because you might have a list of 10 criteria for the perfect lover. You meet someone who ticks all your boxes and they do absolutely nothing for you. And then you meet someone who ticks none of the boxes and you're completely blown away. And that's the reason to act first and think afterwards, that by actually experimenting in the real world, that's when you're most likely to find the job that's really for you.
Although when you experiment in the real world, what about the economic ramifications? I mean, you said she kept a job part-time in order to, you know, keep money coming in, but some people need more than that.
That's right. So not everybody has the courage or the financial means to take a radical sabbatical for a whole year, like the woman I spoke about. But there is an alternative, and this is the way that most people find fulfilling work, and it's called doing branching projects or temporary assignments. So what you do, instead of walking into work on Monday morning and dramatically handing in your resignation letter, which you don't really have to do, you can hold on to your existing job, but you start doing experiments on the weekend or in your spare time. On your Saturdays and Sundays, you start trying out doing a bit of freelance web design, or you teach yoga on a Thursday evening. You start taking these small steps, and those small steps actually help you build up the confidence to then later make a larger change. Or you might find out that actually teaching yoga was not for you. So these branching projects are really, really important if you're actually going to find fulfillment. And the reality is that, you know, we might decide what job to do when we're in our early 20s or even in our teens, but the reality is that we change as people throughout our lives, that our self and our work tend to drift out of alignment over time. So I think everybody at some stage of their life needs to start doing some of these branching projects and being a bit more experimental if they can.
And let's take a few calls. We have Santiago in Pinecrest. Hi.
Yes, hi. I'm struck by the approach of your guest, which is essentially an approach of looking for salvation for yourself by yourself. And you brought up the difficulties of the lady with the two jobs and the three children, and the answer was, well, she should find a hobby. Is that really realistic given the structure of our economy? I chair the Economic Justice Committee at my church, Coral Gables Congregational Church, and what we are examining is the relationship between the structure of the economy and the welfare of the people in it. I'm sure, for example, that your guest is familiar with the work of Michael Marmot on stress in the workplace, Michael Marmot and many others. Is it really realistic to expect the vast majority of people in our society to find the kind of individual heaven that our speaker is talking about?
Okay, well, that's a really interesting question, and I absolutely take the point about that the structure of the economy is such that it is not designed to provide people with fulfillment, that people are struggling, that, you know, unemployment might be 7%, but people are also doing temping jobs, struggling to make ends meet, struggling to meet their mortgages. And I think given those structural constraints, the idea of fulfilling work certainly isn't for everyone. But I think there's a couple of really important things to remember. One is that even if you're in the unemployment line, you know, and aren't able to find work, for example, you're affected by recessions, that you still need to make choices about your life. You still need to decide, well, are you going to try and retrain as a school teacher or an accountant? Are you going to try and work freelance or try and find a steady job? And these are all questions that are partly about making ends meet, but they're partly about what's going to work for you and what's going to fit in with the kind of life you have, the number of children you have, and your economic situation. So because we have to make choices, we need to think very hard about the possibilities. And the other thing is that I think even particularly in dark economic times when things are tough for you, those are sometimes the times to be more creative with the way you think about what job options are out there. So for example, in modern culture, we have this idea that the best way to enjoy your work and be fulfilled is to become a specialist in a narrow field, effectively a high achiever. But I think a growing number of people are thinking that actually if I want to fulfill myself, I want to be not a high achiever, but a wide achiever, that I have many different interests or talents, different sides to my personality. And the idea of being a wide achiever, of course, you know, for example, you might work as a gardener a couple of days a week and a few days a week as a school teacher or whatever it happens to be, juggling several jobs. But that idea of being a wide achiever or what's often called a portfolio worker, you have a portfolio of jobs, is actually a really smart thing to do when economic times are tough because it's about spreading the risk over several careers because we all know that we can be downsized or outsourced at any moment.
Yeah, I think all of your points, I think, are valid and good. I hope you'll write your next book about how we build a society in which more people can lead more fulfilling lives.
Well, luckily, my next book is called Empathy, A Handbook for Revolution, and it's exactly on that topic.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling. We have a tweet. I don't know the name of the tweeter. I see there's no name, but is part of the ennui about jobs the detachment between work and rewards?
So, what is the difference there between the problem of work and rewards? Well, it depends what the issue is there. I mean, partly the issue is that you know, some people are getting, even people who get high rewards for their work, financial rewards, if we're thinking that kind of rewards, aren't necessarily the most satisfied people. In fact, surveys in North America show that lawyers are the most unsatisfied profession, even though they're one of the best paid. And interestingly, reward, of course, is not so much a function of what you get gained financially, but one of the most important things for reward is respect in the workplace. We all need to feel recognized and appreciated by others. And in the past, one of the ways people tried to pursue this in general was through trying to do high-status jobs, which were admired in the community. But more and more people are recognizing that it's respect rather than status that matters. And respect, what I mean by that, is the idea of feeling appreciated as an individual for your work and for your contribution. You might get that working in a big company, you might get it in a small company, but it isn't necessarily determined by how much you get paid or where you are in the hierarchy. It's more about your relationships at work, what your boss is like, what your colleagues are like. And so that's why job satisfaction surveys always put not only things like autonomy at the top of the list of things that matter, but that sense of respect and the quality of your relationships in the workplace.
And let's go back to our callers. We are a little bit short on time. David in Boca, hi.
Good afternoon. Join the show very much.
Good.
In the outset, the author stated that job dissatisfaction is at a high and in the U.S. now. And from my personal experience, I'd say a lot of that has to do with people working, not necessarily for money, but to maintain health insurance. Stuck in a job that you really don't want to do, but has, you know, that major benefit that, unlike in Europe, you can get elsewhere or supplied elsewhere.
That's a great point. What do you think, Roman?
And I think that's absolutely one of a major difference between these different sides of the Atlantic. You know, because of course, compared to Europe, workers in Europe can't really understand the U.S. health system and the importance of people not wanting to lose their insurance, and that really cutting down on flexibility for the kind of work that people can do. And that is a very, very harsh reality, which one hopes, you know, that future legislation will try and deal with. But that is definitely one of the things which holds people back, and all the more reason why we need to think about all those reasons why we can try and, or how we can try and find fulfilling work by staying in the jobs that we've already got, particularly that idea of flow, or seeking more autonomy and trying to find respect and things like that. I mean, one of the great modern ways of trying to find work without changing jobs is the idea of, you know, working from home and flexible working. But if there's a movement in the United States against this. Famously, a couple of months ago, Yahoo's boss Marissa Meyer banned all her workers from working at home, so they had to be all in at the office. Now, that's probably going to not have very good effect on job satisfaction, and probably even not very good effect on worker efficiency, and I really think that it's moving backwards. But I think the reality is that, particularly in the United States, that the idea of trying to make the best of what you've got is a reality for a serious section of the population.
Roman, we only have about a half a minute left, but let me ask you, what's the worst job you've ever had, and is your present one the best?
Probably the worst job I ever had, and I didn't expect this, was being a gardener. I used to be a college professor and gave it up because I wanted to get back into nature, and I thought I'd absolutely love it, and it was a disaster. And that was partly about respect, which I mentioned earlier, because people would walk past me as I was weeding in these gardens, and nobody would even say hello. They didn't even look at me. And that really started eroding my self-respect, and I just didn't imagine that was going to happen. And whether my current job is the most exciting and interesting I have, I'm working as a writer. I have the benefits of the freedom of being a writer, but I have the insecurities of having two small children and having to live on a freelance income. So there's always uncertainty out there. But I still believe it's worth trying to be experimental with your job choices if you can.
Well, we want to thank you, Roman Kruznarek. He's a cultural thinker and writer on the art of living and a founding faculty member of the School of Life. And his book is entitled How to Find Fulfilling Work. We want to thank you so much for joining us.
Been a great pleasure and privilege to be on the program. Thank you.
Food and Dining is next.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. This Friday, Bass Museum of Art presents Brookhart Jonquil and his exhibition Using Candles to Celebrate the Good and Lament the Atrocities Happening All Around the World. It's part of Fridays at the Bass, where the museum is open until 9 p.m. Details at bassmuseum.org.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's Here and Now, now heard Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m.
It's a news magazine designed to keep you up to date with the day's news.
And introduce you to amazing people far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. And we look forward to the Labor Day weekend. Of course, it's the time when many people fire up the patio grill. They have friends and family over. So today we have an expert advice on how to grill to perfection and not to serve dried out, overcooked meats and veggies. So here's chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer with more.
Hello, Joe.
Always good to see you.
And Bonnie,
hello.
Nice to see you.
Hello.
Okay, thinking about barbecue this holiday. So have either of you ever turned out burned, blacked, dried out chicken? Or maybe that steak that's charred on the outside and raw inside?
How about some underdone chicken? That's bad.
That's even worse. Okay. Well, here to give us some tips on how we can avoid all of that is Adam Rappaport. He's the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine, and he's the editor of The Grilling Book, The Definitive Guide from Bon Appetit.
That's quite a tome there, isn't it?
It's huge. It's huge. Let's welcome Adam Rappaport.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. Excellent.
Good.
Great to have you with us.
Good to be here. I'm not actually there, but I'm calling from the North Fork of Long Island, where my grill is actually fired up right this minute.
Now, are you watching the ocean from the beach or whatever there?
Technically, I'm watching the Sound, which is, I guess, the Long Island Sound. So I'm actually looking west towards Connecticut. It's very confusing. But, yes, I have a nice ocean view, and the grill is going, and, you know, all is good right now.
Now, are you a gas or charcoal guy?
That's the ultimate question. I am a charcoal diehard loyalist.
Hooray for you.
All right.
The house we are renting has a gas grill. So you make do, you know. As a famous chef, Greg Kuntz, once said, blame the man, not the pan. And so, you know, you make do with the equipment you have.
Okay. Well, let's let our listeners join in. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions or maybe have some of your own tips? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Email is open, radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
And also with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that's in today's Miami Herald, and also his wine column is in today's Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'm a backyard griller myself, so I'm looking forward to some of these tips, and I'll have some wine suggestions to go with them.
Sounds good to me.
Can I just say one thing? You had a great column today, Fred.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Always nice to hear that.
Yes, I loved it. It's all about grilling.
It's all about what?
Grilling veggies.
Oh, yes, she's a veggie person. Let's go to Adam Rappaport. First of all, congratulations on the grilling book. It's really a guide on how to grill, along with 350 recipes. And as Joe recently just said, it's enormous. It must weigh 5 pounds.
I would say ginormous even. It's a lot of book. It's a veritable grilling Bible. You know, it's important. People want recipes, but I also think with grilling, I always feel that grilling is much more about technique than it is about recipes. And if you know how to get that great sear on a piece of whether it's pork or chicken or steak, and then, you know, understand whether you want the medium rare on the inside or cook through, because as you guys noted before, no one wants medium rare chicken. Once you master those techniques, then whether you want to go, you know, American or Asian or Mediterranean, the flavoring can sort of, you have more confidence to sort of freelance a bit in terms of how you want to, you know, inflect your flavors.
Right. Well, let's talk about those techniques, that black and charred chicken. How do we avoid that from, or even meats, how do we avoid them from being charred on the outside and not cooked inside?
couple of basic points. You know, with chicken, you don't want high direct heat. You want the heat to be a bit lower because, like I said, you don't want blackened on the outside and medium rare on the inside with chicken. So you, if you're using charcoal, let the coals die down a bit. Or also, I think the first rule of building a charcoal fire is you want two sides. You want to sort of bank the coals so one side of the fire is very hot. And that's where, you, for instance, you would sear your steak to get that nice sort of mahogany crust on the outside. And then once you've gotten that crust, you might want to slide it over to the lower side where the coals are not as intense. And that allow you to sort of cook it through without continuing to sear it. And with chicken, for instance, you always want it on that lower side because chicken, like I said, you need time to cook it through.
So low and slow,
exactly. Yeah. And then the big mistake that so many of Americans make, they'll apply that very sweet, sugary barbecue sauce right away, and what ends up happening, because it has so much sugar, it ends up burning. Mm-hmm. So with chicken, for instance, get it cooked all the way through, get it crispy and golden, then apply the barbecue sauce at the very end. And so that sort of, you want to shellac it kind of and give it that finishing glaze, but the mm-hmm. good, smart thing to do is you can take the chicken, and in order to season it, you can come up with like a barbecue dry rub, which is like salt, pepper, maybe a little sugar, some cayenne, some chili powder, and rub the meat while it's, you know, in the fridge, and let it sort of absorb that flavor. So even without that barbecue sauce at the end, the meat will still itself have a lot of
great flavor. Well, let's go back to apparently Joe is a charcoal person along with you.
And not briquettes person. Either.
So, the lump hardwood charcoal, God mm-hmm. bless it.
So tell us, if you're going to do briquettes, what's a quick and easy way to get them going, and how long should we do it in advance?
I think so much of barbecuing is timing. You know, you've got to add in that extra half hour, 45 minutes for the coals to get really hot, get light, catch a fire, then kind of die down to that nice glowing orange. I use lump hardwood charcoal. It's just cleaner and hotter, and there's no additives or God knows what's in there. Like I said, the briquettes I kind of describe as like the chicken nuggets of the charcoal world. You're not quite sure what's going on in there. They're very compressed and whatnot, but they're fine. They burn evenly. You just don't want the kind that are pre-soaked with all the chemicals. I use a charcoal chimney, which is the best creation ever. It's just like looks like a metal chimney with a handle. You pour all the coals in, and beneath it, you stuff it with newspaper. You light the newspaper on the bottom, and it creates this suction, and the fire just rips through it, and the coals are going in 15 minutes, and it's awesome. My parents were big fans of that little electric coil, like the handle with the electric coil at the end that you plug in and you stick under the coals.
I always find that's dangerous, because when it comes out, it's still very hot.
It's still very
and
hot.
Where do you put it?
I've definitely melted the handle a few times, so, you know, in terms of there's something more analog and just classic about the chimney. And the chimney, I don't know the physics behind it, but it's amazing how well it works and how quickly that fire gets going. And, you know, everyone from Weber, whoever makes them, you can get them at your Home Depot, no problem
sure.
at all.
Right.
I'd like to know, Adam, what is the advantage of coals or, you know, charcoal over gas?
Well, I mean, heat, basically, and heat and smoky flavor. You know, if you're grilling over gas, you're essentially just holding a piece of meat over basically the same thing you have on your gas grill, gas, you know, stovetop. It's just little blue flames. There's no fire. What's interesting, if you have charcoal, it's like this wall of intense heat that creates this very even sear on your meat or vegetables. Whereas on a lot of times you'll notice on gas, you get the little grill marks, but you don't get that crust all over. The other problem with gas, I find, in order to get that really intense heat, you got to close the lid. And when you do that, and you can see on the little thermometer, it'll get up to 600 degrees or so, which is great. But when you do that, you're essentially roasting, and you're cooking the meat through. So unless you have a really thick steak, you often end up overcooking whatever on the grill. So it's a challenge.
So you're cooking on a gas grill now, and you're going to have to survive for the weekend?
Yes.
Okay.
So I brought some very thick steaks out, ribeyes from my butcher in New York City. You make the burgers a little thicker. Like I said, you make do, but you just, as long as you sort of understand.
Well, what
the
about taking a gas grill and adding some smoke to it? How do you feel about that?
You can do the smoke chips where you soak the smoke chips, you know, and you stick it down there, and that creates a smoky flavor. That doesn't affect the heat output at all. It will impart some smokiness, and, you know, whether whichever sort of flavor chips, I guess you could say, that you want. You know, I'm more interested in heat than I am in smokiness, but, you know, that'll at least lend some character to what it is you're grilling.
Okay, so now let's talk about the grill grates, because I hear some people say oil the, you know, first of all, they should be clean, but
yeah.
Oil the grill grates, and other people say, no, don't do that. You need to oil the food.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point first about cleaning them, you want to brush them clean every time. And the more you brush them clean, the more they stay clean. You know, if you wait three times so they get all built up, it's harder to get that crust off. You know, I think with, you know, we'll talk about like fish, for instance, you know, it doesn't hurt to oil the grates a little bit, just with like a paper towel and some vegetable oil. But the key, I think the mistake that a lot of people make is that they try to flip their, whether it's a burger or whether it's fish, before it's ready to be flipped. Because when it's really hot and it gets crispy, the meat will release itself from the grill. If you're trying to flip it too soon, it will still be adhering to the grill grates itself, and that's when stuff kind of falls apart. So I think one of the things, you've got to be patient.
Right, again, what you're talking about is timing is important when you're barbecuing or grilling. Do you have an email, Bonnie?
We do. Felix says he uses charcoal, and after perfectly grilling four steaks, veggies, and peaches, notices that there's plenty of life left in the coals. Should I bake a cake, or what does your guest suggest?
That would be an interesting one. You know, I think with a lot of times people will, there's things you could do, like people will bury, we have a recipe for sort of burying eggplants in the coals, or sometimes like sweet potatoes, things like that. You can grill, quote unquote, grill stuff right in the coals themselves, actually.
You could grill some bacon, too.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I do. My brother got me turned on to, we have a restaurant, Peter Luger's, a steakhouse up in New York, which does this grilled bacon very famously as an appetizer. You buy some, go to the butcher if you have one, or a meat counter, and ask for your bacon thick cut. If they have the slab bacon, they can cut it about, you know, a good quarter to a third inch thick each. You put that right on the grill, gets it super crispy and crunchy, but still thick enough so it's almost like ham. And then when it comes off the grill, you glaze it with some sweet sort of steak sauce, horseradishy, almost like cocktail sauce.
How do you avoid a fat fire if you're grilling bacon?
You don't. Short answer is, that's one of my main points I try to make in the book. Grilling is not a science, it's not perfect. It's more of an art. And what's fun about it is that you're constantly being challenged. And you never, I don't know if there's any golfers out there, but I think what people love about golf is that you never master the game. And with grilling on charcoal fire, it's the same thing. Like, you're always having to adjust. You're having to move the meat. You're having to figure out the fire. Slide it this way, and like I said, if you have that two-zone fire where it's hotter on one side and low on the other, if it starts to flame up, you slide the bacon or the steak or whatever it is over, let the flame ups die down. Sometimes people have a little spray bottle of water. But that's what's great about grilling. You can't just put it on there and walk away. You've got to be on it.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about grilling with Bon Appetit editor Adam Rappaport. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Adam Rappaport. He's the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine, and he's the editor of the grilling book, The Definitive Guide from Bon Appetit. He's been giving us some really great grilling tips, and this book is just amazing. It's enormous. But it's Dinner in Minutes time. And so for today's Dinner in Minutes, it's Mike Golick's Barbecue Blitz Chicken Wraps.
That's the football guy, right?
I bet you didn't think I knew.
Mike and Mike.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm a big fan of Mike and Mike. I listen to him every morning. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Well, I interviewed him recently, and he told me he likes to cook a really simple food, and he throws everything on the grill. For this Dinner in Minutes recipe, he grills boneless, skinless chicken thighs.
Chicken thighs. Can I just jump in 1 minute?
Yeah,
best
sure,
thing
of course.
In the world.
Skinless. Skinless.
But boneless chicken thighs have so much more flavor and richness than chicken breasts. And whether you're doing skewers or just marinate them, throw them on the grill, they're so awesome. And if you can find them, buy them.
Oh, you can find them here.
Then all you have to do is wrap it in bacon and it's saved.
funny how that works.
Well, anyway, you're going to grill those thighs. Then you're going to grill some sliced onions with that, about 5 minutes, and turn them over a few more minutes. And then you take some corn tortillas and you put that in foil and put that on the grill for several minutes to warm them through. Shred the chicken. Place it on the warm tortillas, add your onion slices, maybe some chopped tomatoes and lettuce, and he serves that with grilled corn on the cob. And he peels the corn, he wraps them in foil with butter, and here's what I like. He puts Parmesan cheese in it with the butter. That complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And you can find another quick and easy recipe for this weekend. It's a fresh tuna burger with jalapeno potato salad. It's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, Fred, we're really thirsty now.
Well, I'm ready for that. And okay. Actually, with Labor Day coming up, I think there's an actual federal law that says you have to go out in the backyard and grill something. And, of course, when you do that, you end up with a particular kind of food that needs a particular kind of wine. First, you want nothing over $20 a bottle. It's a day for drinking hearty wine with hearty food, and you want bold, powerful wines, and there's nothing subtle about grilled foods, so there should be nothing subtle about the wines that go with them. For example, powerful grilled red meat like steak, burger, lamb, and such create the perfect setting for a nice, unsubtle Cabernet Sauvignon. And I was tasting the 2011 Sonoma Cab from Louis Martini, which is very hearty and spicy, and it's $18. Second, the latest hip cool thing that I was writing about in the Herald this morning for among backyard chefs is grilled vegetables. And we're not just grilling onions and asparagus anymore. Today we're grilling eggplant, bell peppers, mushrooms. Even I grilled some carrots last weekend and they were fabulous. And you can even grill a romaine lettuce and make a grilled Caesar salad.
How did you cut the carrots?
I got the smaller one, not the little ones, but the slim ones. But you do have to cut, if you have a big one, you have to cut it in half so that the carrots are about the same size, so they cook in the same time. And sometimes you parboil them a little bit before you put them on the grill, so you just leave it on the grill long enough to get those grill marks. And with something like that, a lot of the vegetables have kind of herbal flavors, so they're nicely matched by the herbal flavors of a Sauvignon Blanc. And I was trying the herbal and very zingy 2012 New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc from Kim Crawford. It's $15, and it's really nice. Another new trend is grilled desserts, as we were talking about earlier.
Now you're coming to my section.
Well, I'm sorry, Linda, but we don't grill chocolate very often.
So. Oh, sorry.
But we grill a lot of other things. We grill pineapple slices, have pears and peaches and cantaloupe. And some people even grill pound cake or angel food cake and serve it with the top quality vanilla ice cream. And it's really fabulous. And with this, of course, you need a sweet white wine. And the hottest of these right now are the Moscatos. And I was trying the 2012 Banrock Station Pink Moscato from Australia. That's only $11. So you should give these a try, and you should prove that you're a loyal, upstanding American by sipping a cool glass of wine while standing all day downwind from a smoky 1,500-degree charcoal fire.
Fred, I posted this on my Facebook today, and I got somebody wrote me back and said that she is not going to grill because it's so hot down here. And all I can think of is your technique for grilling in the heat. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, what I do in Miami is to open the back door, pull the grill on the porch up right as close as you can get it to the back door, turn the AC down as low as it'll go, and put a big fan shooting across the AC and shooting across the back of your body, and then getting an ice-cold glass of champagne. And it makes it pretty comfortable to grill.
And then you eat on picnic on the floor in the living room?
Yeah. Yeah, one time I even Xeroxed a bunch of ants and threw them around on the floor so we'd think we had a picnic going.
Okay, did you have an email?
Well, this is for Adam. It's a short one.
Yeah, go ahead.
He, or our emailer, recently trimmed several large branches from a mahogany tree. Would I be able to use those thicker branches as a natural charcoal?
I would say yes. It's interesting. I was talking to a guy from this great grill maker called Grill Works up in Michigan who makes these beautiful sort of rotisserie-style grills, and what he likes to do is use a mix of charcoal and wood. The wood sort of, like I said, imparts flavor into the food, but the charcoal kind of keeps it going steadily. So he'll sort of have a charcoal base with the wood on top or mix it up. And yeah, absolutely.
But that wood would have to be well aged, not green.
Exactly. You want it dry because, the green young wood, it ain't going to burn.
Let's talk about something that a lot of people will be doing this weekend, and that's barbecued ribs. Mm. So tell me, what's the best cut and what's the best tip here?
Well, I make the best ribs ever. I'm just going to say
it. Of course, we would have thought that, Dad.
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, like I said, for us backyard grillers, we are not barbecuing, and that's a big distinction among, you know, people from Memphis and Texas, where it's a over low smoke heat over, you know, 8 hours. But if you just have a Weber grill or gas grill or whatever, I like to buy barbecue pork spare ribs, the bigger ones. Take them out, coat them in a dry rub. Like I said, salt, sugar, pepper, some cayenne, some chili, garlic, whatever. Rub them, and then put them in a sheet tray and bake them for about 3 hours covered with a little liquid underneath. Could be orange juice or water or whatever at about 300 degrees. And at that point, they're fall apart tender, and that's what you want. You want them falling off the
bone. So you're baking this inside?
Yeah, because unless you're willing to be out there for 6 hours and indirect heat and feeding the coals and all that stuff, bake them inside. You can even do this a day before. And so at this point, they're flavorful. They're falling off the bone. Take them out, let them cool off, wrap them in foil. You can even refrigerate them. And then the next day, what you do is you got the fire going over medium heat. You put them on the grill until they start to get nice and crispy. And at that point, you shellac them with a nice sweet barbecue sauce. And they'll get all crispy and bubbly and just gooey. And you take them off, you hack them up, and they're just falling off the bone tender. They got so much flavor. They're delicious. Because the big mistake people make is they put them on the grill, they don't grill them long enough, and they're tough and chewy. And no one wants a tough and chewy spare rib.
Now that we're all drooling and starving and hungry, it's been a very tasty week that's gone by. Adam Rappaport, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you. He's the editor of Bon Appetit, their new book, The Grilling Book. And it's the definitive guide from Bon Appetit. It's an excellent guide for anybody who wants to do some grilling. And it's got 350 recipes in there. So it's a great book. And I see Joe Cooper's eyeing the book. He's going to take it from me.
Oh, yeah.
Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie Berman, you ate well today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, next week we're going to be talking with TV celebrity Ann Burrell. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical expertise from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information and many links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we're off for Labor Day. Next week's first program examines immigration reform. Today's recipe at dinnerminutes.com. And now the calendar. On this day in 1920, 93 years ago, the birth of jazz sax giant Charlie Yardbird Parker in Kansas City, Kansas. The founder of bebop, he said he practiced 15 hours per day for 3 or 4 years. He died at age 34. Billy's Bounce, Ornithology. And on this day in 1966, 47 years ago, the last public concert performance of the Beatles at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. The last song they played, the cover of Long Tall Sally. One more while we remember the great Nat King Cole as the Sunrise Kid. On this day in 1987, 26 years ago, the death of tough guy actor Lee Marvin in Tucson, age 63. His Best Actor Oscar came from his dual role in 1965's Cat Ballou with Jane Fonda. So we leave with this thought from Lee Marvin. As soon as people see my face on a movie screen, they know two things. First, I'm not going to get the girl. And second, I'll get a cheap funeral before the picture's over. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Next on WLRN, it's Here and Now from NPR News.